morning.
Good morning.
It's a real joy for me to be here for the week, and a real added joy to be able to come and give the share a talk with you this morning. Took me a while to finally settle on what it was I wanted to talk about, so I hope it works. I think it will.
Could you tell people where you're from? And
oh, sure. Yeah, that's true. I know many of you, but some not. So I'm from Cleveland. I've been studying under Mike for several years now and lead Zen groups both in Cleveland and in Mansfield, which will also come out in my talk too, but just by way of a brief intro. And then actually what I had in mind for the talk this morning, after I wrestled with, well, what kind of Dharma traditional type talk was I going to choose? But I tend not to be a traditionalist, so as I worked through that, nothing was really resonating with me, and suddenly it dawned on me. You know, why don't I come in here, especially for the benefit of those that don't know me at all, but even those that do don't know me that well, because I only get here typically for sesshins where we're not allowed to talk anyway. So now I can talk, and I thought I would share with you a week in the life, a Dharma week, of course, because ultimately this practice isn't about so much what we do here, but it's about what we do outside of Jikoji or our sanghas, wherever they may be. So I thought it might be helpful just to talk in terms of how this Dharma gets practiced out in all the crap that we find ourselves in the midst of. And what I'll do is share with you my own personal examples, but there's nothing particularly special about those. We all have our own examples. So hopefully this will trigger within each of you some help in how to carry this practice forward into your own life. So the starting point for this week in review, since I settled on doing this actually 2 weeks ago precisely, Sunday, August the 25th, it's really that week, but I backdated it a day because the previous day had been kind of a special day, so I decided I'm going to go back, include Saturday in this week, and then it'll end with the Friday. The Saturday was a special day in terms of the formal practice, because it was each month we do an all-day practice session, a zazenke, that in this instance ran from 8:30 in the morning till 4:30 in the afternoon. So lunch is included. And it was a particularly special one for me because a student who some of you know, because he was here last October, Chris Wimmer. He received Jukai at the end of that sesshin. This was going to be the occasion for his first round of Dharma talks. He had a poem, Song of the Grass Hut by Shito, that's deeply resonated with him, and I wanted to give him a chance to share his insights into that poem with the entire sangha. And it went well would be an understatement. He clearly has a gift for sharing Dharma, which I suspected to be the case. I'd like to pass this around. This was a photo prop that he brought, a depiction. This comes from a Mother Earth News, okay, so we could visualize an example of a grass roof hut. Another noteworthy thing, lesson for me at the end of that day of practice, was someone who came up to me, and she was blown away by Chris's teaching, but the thing that particularly struck her about the day of practice, because she hadn't practiced through a meal with us before. She would take it in smaller increments and either leave before the meal or arrive after. She said the way we took the meal in silence, complete silence, was really impactful for her. She lives by herself, and normally at mealtime she has some sort of distraction going on, be it a TV or she's reading something. And it really kind of, doing that practice, impressed upon her the beauty of just eating and not devoting one's attention, splitting it in several different ways. So something, a part of a practice day that we might take for granted because we've done it so often that it's almost lost its meaningfulness to us. Not really, actually, it's just become so deeply ingrained we're not aware of it any longer. It's just part of us. For someone who's not in that place, to actually have that experience for the first time, it's a reminder about the value of all the different forms, the forms that we've taken into our DNA by this point, many of us have, that for those who haven't, these are special forms, each and every single one of them. And it's nice to be reminded of that and come back with that sense of beginner's mind to these practices and really recognize the deep teaching that they all have and the way they do impact our lives going forward, that we can engage in that practice of just doing this. And that's really what formal practice is ultimately about, whether it's just sitting, just walking, just listening to a talk. It's just this. So that evening, just briefly, music is very important in my life too. So there'll be some musical pieces throughout this week. And Saturday night, being from Cleveland, I'm blessed with one of the best orchestras in the world. And their summertime home is a beautiful place, Blossom Music Center, kind of like a Tanglewood or a Hollywood Bowl. There's a pavilion section, but there's also a lawn, a sloped lawn, where your people bring chairs, picnic baskets, wine is allowed, and you can make a full evening of it and listen to some beautiful music. My interest that particular evening was the Schubert Ninth Symphony, referred to as the Great Symphony. And here again, in terms of practice, kind of an awareness of all that's involved, all the things that come together, at least some of the major things that come together in listening to a performance like that. I mean, obviously, it all begins with the composer and what he wrote. And that was one of the major hooks for me. The Beethovenian development of themes mixed in with Schubert's leader-like melodies that were always flowing forth from him. That certainly was reason enough for me to be there. But the orchestra, the conductor, the venue it's in, the instrument makers, me, sitting there listening to it. All these things coming together to create the experience that I had sitting out there on the lawn listening to this beautiful work and fully appreciating all those different pieces and how they fit together. I've had the pleasure of attending a number of Cleveland Orchestra rehearsals, so I have a bit of a sense of what goes into the preparation of those things. And orchestra members can focus and concentrate as well as any Zen master. I'll tell you that, going through a rehearsal. The fact you'd have 60-plus musicians on the stage, and they can, all of them, follow a conductor's instructions, where they're going to start a piece on their score, pages of score. They're right there on the beat, and when the conductor stops them and wants to go over a piece, and sometimes it's several times. I mean, they are just right there scribbling their notes. And at the end of it, sometimes after I've seen a rehearsal that week, I go and catch the polished performance that weekend. And it's incredible to actually have been there as it's being given birth. and the amount of work that goes into it, no matter how talented these musicians are, it's still about being open to each conductor that comes in. Many guest conductors in the course of a season, they may have their own ideas about a piece, but the guest conductor has his own ideas, and he gets to decide. Kind of goes with the turf. Kind of like Mike here, right?
Oh, yeah. Petty tyrant that I am. Yeah.
So there's that openness combined with that technical mastery and working at it until it becomes ready for performance. So that pretty well takes care of day one. Sunday was actually one of those days I relish because there was absolutely nothing on the calendar. It was a completely open day. My daughter was supposed to come over at 4 o'clock. So I, again, speaking musically, I kind of compare days like that to like Keith Jarrett during one of his solo concerts where he sits down at the piano and doesn't know what's going to come. It just, let's see what flows. So for me, that's a free day. I get up, get the coffee going, and you know, I'm Keith on the piano bench. Let's see what comes. Although I kind of know the intro if it's Sunday because I'm going to sit there and read the paper. That is one of my pattern behaviors. And this particular Sunday was striking because, as is the case in many cities, I think the papers keep shrinking and shrinking so I can finish it sooner than used to be the case. But there were a couple of book reviews that really caught my eye. In fact, one of them I ended up buying, The Distraction Addiction. I thought not only could I find it helpful, but just as a teaching tool for people, because we're all caught up in this. And I knew I had to bring this here coming to Silicon Valley. I mean, this is where it all emanates from. At least that's the way the rest of the world looks at it. And the author of this has a website that's contemplativecomputing.org. He even talks about breathing while you're checking email because they found they have a condition they term email apnea. People literally stop breathing while they're checking their email. So it can be very bad for you. He's all about trying to help us navigate this new high-tech era we're in and still remain really connected with each other. Not like this family portrayed on the cover, where a typical family at dinner anymore. They all have their particular device they're working with. It's not the discussion about what happened at school today. You know. Rather, the students in this scene are texting their friends or checking Facebook or something. There's no real personal interaction. There was another book I didn't end up ordering, but I thought it was interesting. It appears in the same paper as this one. It was by an author by the name of Susan Cain, and the title of her book was Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. And it was talking about the preference that's given to the extroverted personality in our world. That it's like the world belongs to the aggressive people, the loud people, the people that can force their way. And she was trying to draw attention to the other side. And of course, we all of us have both sides within us. It's like all the dualities. So it's a nice way, I thought, to remind people of that. That the most extroverted people, and I know a few that are pretty far on that end of the scale. It's kind of a matter of faith that I have to believe they have somewhat of an introvert within them because they don't really manifest that very much. But to recognize that I think we are at a place where the impetus is way to that side, and that I think part of what we bring to the world around us is kind of a bringing back of the needle towards that middle way. There's a time to talk, and then there's a time to be contemplative, and that it's important to have both of those working together, not to just label yourself, I'm an extrovert, this is what I do, this is who I am, or conversely an introvert. Actually, you know, the same territory we've covered from a gender standpoint, that we can now be, many of us can be more comfortable about seeing male and female traits within each of us. I think the same thing certainly applies when it comes to introvert, extrovert. So after going through the paper, another deeply spiritual practice of mine is walking. I have a number of spiritual practices out there. And one of the reasons why I moved into the house where I currently reside about 5 years ago is because it backs onto Euclid Creek, and Euclid Creek Park is a stone's throw. I walk out the front door and I'm there within a couple of minutes. And it's a good hour and a half walk to get to the bottom, turn around, come back. So if I have a free day and the weather's at all halfway decent, it's kind of a given I'm going to find some time to go down there. And there's kind of a sangha of us that we're the regulars. So we get to know each other a little bit and exchange pleasantries. One of them, who was there that particular day that I did want to share with you because he's such a character. He's this shorter Italian man. He's got to be in his late 70s. And if the temperature is above 65, he's not wearing a shirt. And every time I see him, you know, we're both, buongiorno, buongiorno. He has that joy of life about him. And he will talk to everybody that passes by him. So it was definitely made my walk that morning. Also, it was at that point that all of a sudden it dawned on me what talk I was going to give. It's another beautiful thing about just going out walking. Things pop up. And suddenly I had settled on it. As soon as the thought popped into my mind, I said, that's it. So now I've got to start keeping, won't even deem it a journal. It was just kind of paying attention. So it was actually a great exercise for me because it meant for the rest of the week, I'm really being mindful about the Dharma lessons that are part of my regular ongoing life. The other thing about walking in the park is it's kind of similar to the issue we have in a sesshin, is how, as you're walking past someone in the course of the day, you know, the greeting. Of course, there's a huigasho. That's easy. That's the form. But when we're out in the world, what is the form? In a lot of situations, like if you're walking the sidewalks of a busy city, there is no form. You're just constantly passing by people, and there's no acknowledgement whatsoever. One of the nice things about the park is it's not that heavily traveled. So actually there's, even though the people I don't know, there's typically some sort of an acknowledgement. Sometimes it's a good morning, hi. And sometimes you immediately pick up the vibe that, well, no, they're probably not going to be receptive to that. But then there's like this nod, this subtle nod. And it had dawned on me that day, well, that's kind of the gassho in that environment. We acknowledge each other. It would seem kind of odd if I did this to them, because I assume they're not practicing Buddhist. But just a nod, a mutual nod. And that performs the exact same thing. We acknowledge each other. There's probably a lot contained in there. Beautiful day, isn't it? Sometimes you don't need the words. Just the simplest of gestures. If you meet somebody. And that's a form of subtle form of meeting. It's just the nod. So there's a lot of that that goes on during walks in the park, as well as the verbalizations, the hi, how are you, good morning, have a good day. because that's not always the appropriate thing either. And I guess the last thing to wrap up Sunday with is my daughter, who was going to come over at 4 o'clock, she didn't make it. So, not too attached to things, right? Especially if it involves children. But in all things, truly. And I didn't think anything very much of it. It wasn't the sort of thing where I immediately called to make sure she's okay. I sent her an email the next day, just wanted to make sure she's okay. And of course she was. But yeah, these are things that go on constantly too. We're expecting something, or we've been led to believe something's going to happen, and it doesn't. You know, we could become perturbed about it, or okay. So that brings us to Monday, work practice, because I'm not a full-time Zen priest. It's probably come as a shock to you, but the wages aren't very good. So I actually hold down a position in the insurance industry of all things, overseeing the division of an insurance company. Making money for them. So relating that to right livelihood, because it's a publicly traded company. Yeah, their shareholders are looking at profits. My little corner, I can look at other things that the shareholders are much less concerned about, like working conditions and how we treat our customers and so on and so forth. So I'm grateful I'm in that position. And taking the attitude that if you do the right thing, that the money will kind of take care of itself. It's just kind of a reinforcement that what you're doing out there in the world, if you're in the business world, in the commercial world, that will, you know, you're doing the right thing. You have customers. They're willing to pay you for whatever it is, the product or service you're providing. But ultimately, you know, for me, and I know for many other of my colleagues from other insurance firms, people that we do business with, that's really what's at the heart of it. We go into the work each day thinking, well, we're going in to take care of people. That's really what keeps me showing up every day. And you know, some years we'll make more money than other years. But hopefully, if we're doing the right thing, it's generally going to be okay. There will be other people in the organization that kind of get a little more spazzed out over that sort of thing, about how many dollars are we making, and they'll want reports to track against that, and all of that. And again, it's a matter of being able to do that, to interact with those folks, recognizing, you know, they're also trying to give an accounting to other people who are looking at it from a different perspective. But it generally doesn't come down to a point where it's going to directly impact how I'm running a business, the division that at one time I used to have an ownership stake in. It's something I've been involved with for many, many, many years. And as long as it's not interfering with the way we're able to interact in the world, in our interdependent web, which is pretty rich one, then I can be a very good corporate lieutenant and give them all the reports they're looking for that are driven by strictly the dollars and cents. In fact, there's are there any Star Trek fans here? There's a culture that was a world that was heavily featured in the Deep Space Nine series called the Ferengi. And I love that because it was a way of mirroring our capitalist society back to us. This was a culture that was solely driven by seeking profit. And in fact, they have rules of acquisition. 286 rules of acquisition. that they memorize. I mean, this is their life. This is their code of conduct. So just to give you a couple of examples, rule number 10, greed is eternal. Rule number 18, a Ferengi without profit is no Ferengi at all. Number 22, a wise man can hear profit in the wind. So I keep these at my desk. So it was very easy to grab this and throw it in my bag to bring here, because it kind of helps to put into stark contrast how some, it clearly is an ingrained part of our profit-seeking culture. No question about it. Or rule number 97, enough is never enough. The realm of the hungry ghost. But the Ferengi character who was in almost all of the episodes, actually quite, it wouldn't be that unusual that a situation would come up that actually went a little deeper than his drive for profit. You'd start to find there's actually a Buddha's heart beating in there. And I think that was also helpful to recognize and to remember that even these people that are so driven by acquiring more and more and more, and we tend to demonize them, they can be reached. I mean, I'd like to think maybe I've had some success in that over the years, limited as it may be, but nonetheless. So part of Monday, after I went and started my work practice, another really deep Dharma lesson pops up for me. I have a routine dental exam and cleaning, and I had completely forgotten, dismissed something they found 6 months ago the last time, because it never bothered me. And it's still not bothering them. But they see it again. It's not clearing up. And basically, it's calling out for a root canal. So, root canal. Now, the Dharma lesson is what we do with words and thoughts and ideas. I mean, just that term, root canal, scary. You immediately start to, I don't know if I want to do that. Do we have to do it? So yeah, and then I resolved myself, okay. And he sent me off to a dentist that only does those things. So when I called, I figured I'll probably get scheduled in a few weeks. They could take me Thursday. 3 days. Going, I don't know if that's enough time to prepare myself. You know? But I remind myself, I practice Zen. I can do this. I say, yeah, Thursday will be just fine. I'll be there. 9 o'clock in the morning. Great way to start my day. I'll be there. And I'll push that now to Thursday. But I had the next several days to work with that. This, you know, obviously, it's back there in the back of my mind. And maybe you have things that... like that, your own versions of root canals that you know are coming up. And, of course, how I worked with it, I think it's the only way to really effectively work with it is just remind myself. It's what I'm making it out to be. It's my idea about it that I inherit from other people. So I tried not to tell too many people about it, because then they'd react, oh, God, that wasn't going to be helpful to me. So I just kept it to myself. Not, sharing things isn't always helpful. Sometimes it's best to keep them inside if you know others aren't going to be able to help with it. And that evening, another formal practice environment. Another group that I work with is down in Mansfield. And 2 Mondays a month, the second and the fourth Monday, I go down there to sit with them and give the talk. And yeah, to get through the rest of the week in time. I don't know how much I want to go into this, but this particular evening, sometimes, and you probably find this to be the case here, sometimes I go in there prepared to give a talk, but then I'll open it up for discussion over what we talked about last time I was there. And something will come up in the course of that discussion that just causes me to completely redirect the thing and decide this is the path we need to go down. And that's exactly what happened this particular evening. The topic we had looked at the previous time was, we've been looking at Katagiri's Returning to Silence collection of talks. And we were looking at the section that's entitled Impermanence as Buddha Nature. And one of the Sangha members offered the observation of nothing being important. And it struck, of course, in a sense that's true, just as in Sangha, the grass hut, it begins, I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value, nothing important. But that's a tricky concept to work with, because it's also almost putting us into that nihilistic position. Nothing's important. It doesn't matter. So I tried to shift it for them and say, well, another way of looking at that is that everything's important, but it's equally important, so nothing's more important. And I think that's probably what Shito was pointing to when he said there's nothing of value. It's, if everything is of equal value, then there's nothing of value, relatively speaking. And that, to me, is more consistent with the Zen teaching that's always resonated deeply with me, that there's no place you can spit because it's all of value. It's all sacred.
No place you can
spit.
Spit?
Yeah. I like the earthy teaching.
Plus, swallow it.
So we talked about that. And of course, when we went down that path, and somebody in the Sangha, who I deeply respect, is very involved in social issues, you know, his reaction was, of course, some things are more important than others. You know, some causes are more important than others. And, you know, we looked at that, and I tried to point out that seeing everything as being equally important, even two sides in a conflict, could actually create exactly the environment that's required in order to have people able to communicate with each other. But if you have people that are go in convinced that their side's more important than your side, even if you are able to get them to sit down at the same table, there's probably not much that's going to transpire in terms of dialogue. So it was just a real rich, I came away thinking, boy, we really covered some interesting territory about how, again, it comes back to labeling things. If it's valuable, not valuable, important, not important, more important. These are power-laden words, and always words that we have to be careful with. At least for my own practice, value, I guess I work more effectively, I think, with all things are of equal value than saying, along with Shito, that there's nothing of value. Because I can't look outside here and make that kind of a statement. Come to a place like Jokoji and say there's nothing of value. But I realize that when I leave here, you know, I have to see Jokoji in all of the practice environments that I'm practicing in. So they're all equally important. They're all of equal value. But it's not to say that they have no value. They're all of inestimable value. That brings me to Tuesday. Start moving a little quicker here. Tuesday was actually a pretty quick day, although I did get another further email from my daughter finding out that she had been fired from her job and that had happened some time back. So, again, I've already got root canal on my mind. Now my daughter's been fired. Something really, yeah, it really hit me. And even to the point where that night, you know, waking up in the middle of the night just filled with anxiety about her. Because she's been down this road before. And as we all know, it's a difficult environment out there to try and find a job. So this will be an ongoing practice for me about how to be there with her in a skillful way. And that'll have its challenges. So that's just kind of opening chapter in what will probably be an ongoing practice opportunity for me. And then Wednesday, again, I can go through this fairly quickly. The highlight of Wednesday was meeting a Zen practitioner for lunch who I had first spoken to a few weeks prior. He's originally from New York, had practiced at Zen Mountain Monastery from its beginnings. He had been a student of Daido Lori. He was in Cleveland originally because his mother lived there and she was dealing with cancer. And lo and behold, he was diagnosed with cancer. So when he put in a call to me, he was a patient in the VA. He's a Vietnam vet, former Marine. So he was able to get treatment there. And he called me one Saturday night. He had found me on the internet and for whatever reason decided I was the one he wanted to reach out to. So we had a talk. I would ultimately go to visit him at the VA. And it was just one of those guys that I felt like I had known him for quite some time. Just wonderful, wonderful guy. And then this, I would have had the first meeting with him, I think, a week before this lunch. He had a friend from Chicago coming in to spend the day. They went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And they were going to do lunch at a food court down in Cleveland. And he invited me, which was such a delight. And went and you know, he's given his camera to staff there to have them take our photos of hanging out together. Just one of those really special, it kind of impresses the fact that one thing about doing this practice, there are more people out there doing it that you're going to encounter than you may expect. And they just pop up out of nowhere. And, you know, but for my practice, he and a lot of other people I would have never met. I wouldn't have the pleasure of knowing. So it's certainly enriched my life from that standpoint in terms of the people I've gotten to know and become close to. And sometimes it doesn't take a lot of time to become close to somebody. That's another thing about this Zen path. It talks about opening yourself up to others. It's an important part of the path. And when we do that, you know, connections can form quickly and go deep. So that brings us to Thursday, which I've set the stage for. It's root canal day. It's 9 o'clock. I'm there. I'm in the chair. They've given me my Novocaine. And, you know, I'm still, you know, root canal. It's not going to be good. This is going to be a tough ordeal. And the reality was, you know, I started to settle into it, and about midway through, it was almost like root canal samadhi. I had let drop off all the fabrication I'd made over root canal. It was just this. Yeah, just this was I was sitting there with my mouth wide open and put a block under my other jaw to keep that side open. Mm-hmm. But it was no big deal. You know, I'd let go this notion. It's like I'm already 20 minutes into this. Actually, it's not that bad. It's not what I'd made it out to be. You know, why is everybody so freaked out over root canal? It's not so bad. And in that moment, you know, it really was. I was just in that chair, and there was this calm serenity. Unbelievable. Practice can happen anywhere, even in the dentist chair in the middle of root canal. we can tap into these deep, quiet places. And then Friday, I can't leave the talk without bringing a bit more jazz into it. Friday, we left for Detroit for the Jazz Festival. It takes place over Labor Day weekend there every year. Jazz, for me, is really not any different than Zen practice. What they do in terms of being in the moment, being completely themselves, opening themselves. Let me read liner notes from a young and rising artist, Ambrose Akinmusiri, plays trumpet. And the title of his CD is When the Heart Emerges Glistening. And he has a few words about that in here that I think you'll hopefully be as blown away by it as I was. It sounds like it's something being written by a Zen master. When the heart emerges glistening refers to being present, emotionally invested, honest, not exclusively in our art, but in every act of expression. It is about parting our chests to reveal ourselves to one another and to ourselves, to express and reflect honestly the everything of us. And then in brackets, he puts the ugly, the changing, the vulnerable, the fierce, the solid, the safe. The heart glistens because the heart is wet. It is fresh. With every act of expression, it is a newly excavated heart. So that through listening closely, we are ultimately chronicling every present moment and constantly re-examining our changing selves. In bearing ourselves this way, we connect more deeply with one another. The many sides of the album itself are a testament to our complexity and uniqueness as individuals and the imperative to bear and explore honestly every coexisting side of us. I have found that the deepest of jazz musicians go to play the same places that the Zen masters go to. They are very contemplative. And in fact, my own favorite, Wayne Shorter, just turned 80, who's been on the music scene for an awfully long time. He is a practicing Buddhist, and it comes through in his music. It's free jazz in the most intense way. He's not about rehearsing and trying to get a piece down like the Cleveland Orchestra. It's more about four musicians getting on stage, and they'll have themes that will come in from compositions, often his own compositions, but then they become vehicles for exploration, and one of the musicians will take off in a certain direction. They'll, because they're open and listening, they'll go there, and it'll just take some fascinating routes, but to capture that live, the level of intensity, because they're putting everything, their whole life is going into that, and they're listening so intently to their Sangha members so that they can receive and respond in the deepest, most complete possible way. It's going to jazz performances for me is very much a spiritual exercise. And I come away almost universally feeling very uplifted and inspired to continue my practice with the intensity they do theirs. So I think I heard the lunch bell.
Do you have one more day?
Do you end on Friday night?
I end on Friday. I do. But I did have one more day, as it turned out. To go over that.
Well, there's another week to go.
There is. I'll have a rich report for this week when I get back to Cleveland, for sure.
So our assignment, I presume, is to be attentive to our week, like that?
Yeah. See all the, you know, Dharma gates are boundless, as we chant in the Bodhisattva vows, and they really are. They're all ever-present, everything that comes up, from root canal to beautiful concerts. They're all filled with Dharma. And to be able to fully appreciate it. I think it was Maizumi Roshi who had that book, Appreciate Your Life. Beautiful title. Those are words to live by, I think.